You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census Bureau show that the percentage of men in the U.S. labor force has been declining steadily for years. At the same time, the percentage of men who report being a stay-at-home parent has been going up. The group represents a relatively small fraction of the overall population, but the trends are showing no signs of slowing down. And in opposite-sex couples, it has gone along with a rise in women as the main sources of household income. Our next guest has researched those trends in recent years to find out what kind of impact they're having on parents and families. We're looking at that now, and we want to hear your story, too. Have any of the men in your life left the workforce to be stay-at-home dads, full or part-time? Are there women in your life who are the primary earners for their families? Let us know by emailing ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Noelle Chesley is an associate professor and sociology department chair at UW-Milwaukee. I talked to her about this last month. Here's a listen. Well, now, historically, household roles, I think, have been kind of gendered, certain responsibilities split between men and women. What have been some of the downsides of those traditionally, I guess, defined gender roles?
Well, I mean, the downsides are definitely a lack of flexibility, right? When you've got people who specialize in either taking care of the kids or in working a job to earn the family income, if either one of those areas gets disrupted and a person can't do them for one reason or another, it makes it very difficult for the family to respond at that point.
Now, I mentioned some national stats out there showing a steady increase in the number of men taking on those household caregiving roles. There are different ways to measure it, of course. What are you seeing out there as you've looked at research over the past decade or two?
Right. Yeah, you're right. There's people do argue a little bit about the numbers and the trends and sort of how to define this. Mm-hmm. I think what's really important for your listeners to understand is that staying at home without any employment is not very common for either men or women. I mean, in today's world, among couples and people who have children, it's much more common for either both members of a couple to be employed, for single parents to be employed. And we do still have families where there's a full-time at-home caregiver. It's much more likely to be a woman than it is to be a man. But there have been more men entering that role. This is something that we really started to talk about and see a little bit more right after the Great Recession. So right around 2010, I think this was a pretty hot topic. And it sounds like it's reviving a little bit now with some things that are out in the news.
I want to talk about the cultural response to this. In my youth, there was a movie called Mr. Mom that was all about the hilarity that ensues when the dad
yes.
is the household caregiver. Is there still sort of that, I don't know, discomfort or weirdness that people feel about it?
I think so. And I will tell you, I've interviewed families where there's a stay-at-home parent who is a man in the family. And many men that I have talked to hate Mr. Mom. They hate the movie. They hate the name. So definitely don't like that. Feel like it's a little degrading. And yeah, I think there still is some stigma around switching up these roles, actually both for the women who become primary earners for their families and for the men that take on that primary caregiving role.
Can you talk about the economic factors that are leading to some people doing this? I did it myself for a couple of few years there where I was working part-time from home and being Mr. Mom, I guess, for the little kids in the house. What is driving people to do that? Again, not the dominant majority, but what is leading to some of those trends?
Yes, I think that in many ways you could view any kind of a move, especially for men, I think, to become full-time caregivers as symptomatic of really a sort of a lack of good, affordable childcare options, and also a commentary on demanding jobs. So I think what a lot of families find in general is that it's tough to find good childcare. It costs a lot. And so that definitely is a consideration that many families have to take, have to think more about and strategize a little bit about how they want to meet their caregiving needs. And then there just is a problem with jobs being pretty demanding. And so it can be difficult to substitute for the kind of family support you need, if especially if both members of a couple have really demanding jobs. So you'll sometimes see, especially in you forwarded me a Bloomberg piece, you know, there's discussions about people who have two really demanding jobs, and once kids are in the picture, even with, say, a great nanny, they just can't manage that.
We're talking to Noelle Chesley, Associate Professor and Sociology Department Chair at UW-Milwaukee, looking at caregiving men. Trends show men taking on caregiving roles more at home, maybe being, it's rare, full-time stay-at-home dad or part-time, part stay-at-home dad. Women more commonly becoming the breadwinners. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, and also love to hear your experiences wherever you are on these trends yourself, your own family. If you are a dad who's taken on more caregiving roles, love to hear from you. What kind of response do you get? Do you get called Mr. Mom? Do you hate it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, we focused on part one of what we're talking about here, the men maybe being more likely to be caregivers. Also, the trends I mentioned earlier on, Noelle, women being more likely in a two-parent household to be the primary breadwinner, when in the past, usually if a woman was the main breadwinner, statistically it was a single-parent family. What are you seeing in that?
Yeah, well, here I think part of what we're seeing with women and their earning potential is a result of more and more women investing in education. So I can't remember exactly when this happened, but a few years ago, some of your listeners might have remembered reading in the paper something that we now had more women entering college, for example, than men. And that was really positioning a lot more women for these more demanding and often higher paid jobs. And I think that's happened at exactly the time that we've sort of been building on a longer standing trend of declining manufacturing jobs, the wages at some of those jobs that were traditionally done by a lot of men, and especially a lot of men who didn't have more formal education after high school. Wages and opportunities in those sectors of the economy have gotten a lot tougher. So I think there's been, you know, it's a pretty complex mix of a lot of different things going on in the economy, but certainly we're seeing that more and more women are going to be better positioned for higher earning jobs. And as those women marry and, you know, start families, it's going to change the calculus a little bit about how to meet these different needs, about who should work, who should really stay home and take care of kids.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Lake Halley. John, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi, John.
I was listening earlier, and you were talking about men staying home. Well, my wife and I had an interesting relationship in that I work nights and she worked days, so I would stay home with the kids and take care of them during the day, and then while they were sleeping, she would be there to take care of them.
Now, John, that sounds hard to me. I mean, working night shift is tough as it is. What was it like being a child care provider on top of that?
It was very tiring.
I bet.
I didn't get much sleep for about 3 years.
John, thanks a lot for that call. Noelle, sounds like you want to jump in.
Yeah. No, I love that John added that to the conversation, because it's a good reminder about some of the different strategies that families do come up with to handle, you know, this sort of conundrum about how to earn money and how to take care of especially small kids. And what he describes is definitely something that we study and that gets talked about among work and family researchers such as myself, this idea of families having different shifts or trying to manage shifts so that they can always have that 24-hour parental care is something that families do engage in. A lot of families, like John mentioned, find it to be difficult. It can be stressful, and it can also be associated with higher rates of divorce with some of the research that we've seen. Sounds like John was successful in managing that in his own life, but it comes with its own challenges too. He mentioned being really exhausted, and I'm sure he and his wife didn't get to see each other there for very much for a while.
John, thanks so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. This is a fun thing to recall for me because I worked at a daycare center in Seattle in 1987. So I saw this trend years ago that the dads would drop the kids off. They'd pay $3,000 a month. They were very wealthy, and they would I would take care of their kids during the day. But I knew men in Portland, Oregon, when I lived there in 1886, who were lawyers, and they would run their law office out of the house, and they would stay home and take care of the kids. I applaud it because it's very intentional parenting. It's very intentional family planning. I really like that idea.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Some experience from the 80s there, Noelle.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. I mean, one of the great things about some jobs is that it is possible to combine them with childcare during the day. Although I think, especially having just gone through the pandemic, there are parents out there who would talk about the struggles with that. And I'm also just thinking about that commercial, or maybe it was a yeah, I think it's the commercial where the little kid comes in and is interrupting his dad on the Zoom call a little more recently. But sure. Yeah, so not without its challenges to try to do all that out of the house.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We're talking to UW-Milwaukee sociology professor Noelle Chesley about a rise in stay-at-home dads and female household breadwinners. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you and your family? How have you juggled things to make things work with childcare and the employment world? If you are a dad who has taken on most or all of the daytime or nighttime childcare role, love to hear your experience, the reactions you get maybe from friends and family. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Noelle Chesley, Associate Professor and Sociology Department Chair at UW-Milwaukee. With us today, looking at a growing trend of men leaving the workforce to be stay-at-home dads or part-time working and stay-at-home dads, and women serving as household breadwinners more often. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions, 800-642-1234. Karen joins us now in Monona. Karen, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I'm driving. I apologize. When I had my third child, when we had our third child, and at the age that he was two, I had to divorce his father because I was the main breadwinner doing the child, about to do the child care. I was teaching at the time, and what happened was that was what I did. I continued doing child care until the kids were gone and then found another job. I turned into an apartment or a property manager, but since I was late into the career doing that, I still, in my 70s, have to work to make up for the lack of Social Security, et cetera, that allows me now to retire.
Karen, thanks for the call. Karen, bring up an important experience. I had the kids after divorce, single parenting and navigating the world of work. Noelle, we're talking about, well, which parent? Well, what about when which parent is the only parent?
Yeah. Actually, what Karen describes is pretty common for a lot of women. You could also almost think of it as the caregiving penalty because for scholars who study especially poverty at the end of life, one of the reasons we see so many women struggling financially is because of a lot of the time that they either took away from employment completely to engage and care for their families, or because they had to take that more flexible, less well-paying job to sort of accommodate those responsibilities. So I think her story really illustrates that broader pattern that we see oftentimes in the population.
Karen, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We'll go to Alberto in Milwaukee. Alberto, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I was listening to you guys talking about this, and not even the expert here has talked about love and attachment. The attachment the kids get from the parents during those years, how important it is. The same importance the attachment of the kid to the mother's breast milking. No drinking formula. the love and the whole thing, this, the conversation until now has been very transactional, very, very much about money and talking about breadwinner, which I was saying to the person that took the phone up. The breadwinner is a phrase from the 50s that shouldn't be used anymore.
Alberto, thanks a lot for the call. And actually, honestly, I've been saying breadwinner. I don't like that phrase either that much. I just don't have a better shorthand. But Alberto's point about the attachment and a lot of dads, I appreciated having that opportunity when my kids were littler. It isn't just about the money, Noelle.
Absolutely. Yes, I can definitely talk about that. Thank you so much for sort of turning the conversation in that direction, Alberto. And also on the breadwinner thing, I completely agree. We could just say primary earner,
yeah,
or, you know, larger earner or something like that. But one of the things I thought I could mention that I actually discovered in my own investigations of families who were taking this on is that one of the men who took on the role of being a more involved, more primary caregiver to their children oftentimes found that to be really transformational for them. And it's exactly what Alberto's talking about. I mean, they came to value the work that they were doing in the home, their relationships with their children really deepened in a way that, men would often talk about it in this very kind of transformational way. So I don't think we want to completely think about it as like, the work-family equation and how much does childcare cost and all those other things, even though those do weigh into family decision-making.
Thanks a lot for the call, Alberto. We'll go to Tony now with us in Milwaukee. Tony, hi.
Hi, this is Tony. I did want to chime in that I was a full-time stay-at-home dad. Actually, still I might consider myself, but I started back in 2003 when our second daughter was 6 months old. We also had a two-year-old at the time. We actually had options for childcare, but really, my wife and I wanted to do the parenting, the majority of it, at least ourselves. So that was probably the prime factor. My wife had a successful career in real estate. So that was I was an engineer. So her opportunities to bring the family income was much greater than mine. And that turned out to be a great decision. But that was kind of the main thing. And I'll tell you, from my perspective, the hardest thing to deal with was the generation of men older than me. They could really not understand that I would actually give up my career to do this and stay at home. The guys that were my age kind of thought more that, that this, I was retired. They would call me the stay at home mom and all that. They were more jealous, but I found it hard to deal with the generation a little bit older because they just could not understand me giving up my career. So that was the challenges and the enjoyment I had with staying at home with my kids.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Tony. Yeah, definitely. I think some generational attitude changes Tony is reflecting there.
Yeah, I love Tony's story. It sounds a lot like many of the families that I talk to. I mean, different in the details, but just some real central themes. You know, I think for families that have two professional parents. So it sounds like he said he was trained as an engineer and his wife had a job that was also, you know, potentially higher earning. What he described is really typical. I mean, this idea that the parents really value this idea of parental care, and they sort of make the decision to have one person stay home to sort of uphold those values. I will say that there are some real different experiences for families that are not quite in those economic circumstances. So it can feel like less of a choice there for those families.
Thanks a lot for the call, Tony. Gretchen is with us now, also in Milwaukee. Gretchen, hi.
Hi, I'm Gretchen.
What did you want to tell us about Gretchen?
So I'm a teacher at Milwaukee Public Schools, and my husband is a full-time stay-at-home dad, and he is just like absolutely rocking it. But, you know, when he goes out and about, he'll take the kids to the zoo or he'll take the kids to the park. And he always gets comments from a lot of like probably more so older women, he says the most. And, you know, they'll say like, oh, looks like, you know, you've got your hands full. It looks like mommy's day off, or it looks like you're babysitting today. And it just drives him totally nuts. Because, you know, this is his everyday. And typically when I have the kids, I'm the one with my hands full. So it's just kind of unfortunate that people you know, feel like they have the right to make those comments. So it's just kind of too bad.
Interesting, Gretchen. So we heard about the older men from our last caller. Now the older women, too, not quite getting it, Noelle.
Yeah, I think both of those stories together do really illustrate kind of the lag in attitudes in the broader society and sort of the realities of what families are actually doing in their everyday lives.
Gretchen, thanks a lot for that call. Just in our last minute, Noelle, we can't predict the future, but what kind of trends, what kind of things are you watching for when it comes to who provides the caregiving in our households?
I certainly think that families, given the situation that we're in now with the potential for all sorts of disruptions in both employment and the rise of caregiving, I think families are going to have to be really, really flexible in how they deal with this. And more men are going to be pitching in and taking care of both their aging relatives and their young kids. And people are probably going to have to take turns and do different shifts and figure out all sorts of ways to try to manage this moving forward.
Noelle, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yep, thank you.
Noelle Chesley is an associate professor in the sociology department chair at UW-Milwaukee. I talked to her last month about a growing trend of men leaving the workforce to be caregivers at home, women serving as the primary source of income in more households. Still time for you to share your story. How do the caregiving responsibilities break down in your household? Have you or a man in your family left a job to focus more time on the home? How's it been going? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Governor Evers was sworn in for a second term today, setting the stage for a big year in state politics. At the top of the list, the two-year budget will be in the works. What will compromise and cooperation look like between the Democratic governor and the Republican legislature? Will those be words? We say a lot. We'll get a preview of some of the big stories. And the U.S. Postal Service is switching to more electric vehicles in its fleet, along with other big changes in the works. We'll get the latest on the future of mail service in the U.S. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, homelessness gets blamed on poverty, mental health problems, and addiction. But the author of a new book tells us there's a more fundamental problem. Look at the causes and possible solutions with the new book, Homelessness is a Housing Problem. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Southwest Airlines canceled about 70% of its flights across a two-day period after the holidays, uprooting plans, causing some chaos for thousands of people. A travel expert tells us more about what happened and what we can learn from it. First, communities around the country have struggled to find long-term solutions to homelessness. The issue is often blamed on a variety of individual problems like addiction or poverty. But our next guest says those things don't explain differences between one community that might have a lot of homelessness, another that doesn't. In his new book, he says there's one key thing that explains many of those differences, the amount of housing that people can afford. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see problems with homelessness in your community? Have you lived in a place where homelessness was more visible, more rampant, or visited? What kind of solutions do you think would work best? Have you seen solutions that work well? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, experiences. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Greg Colburn is an assistant professor of real estate in the University of Washington's College of Built Environments. He's the author of the new book, Homelessness is a Housing Problem, How Structural Factors Explain U.S. Patterns. Greg, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Happy to be here.
I want to talk about the scope of the problem and kind of the modern era of homelessness. We might think of the Great Depression, okay, economic downturn, lots of people were homeless. In the last few decades, something different has happened. Can you talk about what has been driving homelessness in this modern era?
Yeah, the modern era, it certainly looks very different than it did, early in the 20th century, in the sense that a lot of the most acute homelessness crises are happening in some of the wealthiest cities in the country. And so the modern manifestation of homelessness is really evident in places like Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles. Those are really the big six communities for homelessness in the United States. Not to say it doesn't exist in every community, it absolutely does, but it's disproportionately present in those communities. And the head scratcher here is that those are very, very wealthy, vibrant, dynamic communities, yet we seem to have this big issue with homelessness there. And that's really what I think causes a lot of people to question what is going on here, and really was a motivator for me and my co-author to write this book.
Now, a lot of people will point toward individual causes of homelessness, substance abuse or mental illness, or of course, poverty. You say, of course, for individuals, those might make that person more likely to be homeless than someone else. But when you zoom out and look at a community level, you don't see that as the explanation. Why not?
We don't see that as the explanation because the easiest way to describe this is there are people experiencing poverty, mental illness, and addiction in every city around the United States. What really matters in terms of determining the scale of the homelessness problem is the context in which those events occur. And so where we see homelessness being really, really prevalent, it's places where housing is really expensive and not very available. And so clearly poverty is a cause of homelessness. I would never suggest that. But the example I'd like to highlight for people is Detroit, Michigan, which is the most impoverished city in the United States, has far lower rates of homelessness than the coastal cities that I mentioned before. And so would never dispute the fact that poverty causes homelessness at the individual level, but at the community level, really homelessness thrives in more affluent communities, not in more impoverished communities like Detroit or St. Louis or Cleveland, for example.
In the book, you have an analogy that I'll paraphrase a little bit here. Think of a game of musical chairs. 10 people, 9 chairs in the first round, music stops, 9 people sit down. Rob here, he's slow-witted and slow-moving. I don't have a chair. So I could say, okay, I don't have a chair because I'm slow, or I could say I don't have a chair because there's not enough chairs. Can you talk about that analogy as it affects the housing situation?
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, you know, when I stand up and talk and say, you know, this is related to the housing market, people will say, well, I just saw Rob down on the street corner who is clearly addicted or experiencing mental illness. Therefore, I'm going to equate that experience with the crisis of homelessness. And the musical chairs analogy is important in the sense that when you don't have sufficient chairs or you don't have sufficient housing, it's the people who are vulnerable or have some attribute that's going to make them lose this game. And so when Rob loses the game of musical chairs because he's slow or has a bad ankle or whatever the case may be, we end up focusing on that condition, not on the root cause, which is if we'd had 10 chairs, Rob would have found a chair. And that's really what's happening in Seattle right now, where I live, in the sense that we don't have enough housing units. And so if you're competing against people who are working at Amazon and you're experiencing mental illness, you're going to lose. And the sad outcome from that loss is people are far more likely to experience homelessness, whereas that person in a different context, in a different housing market, might be able to procure and maintain housing. But it's difficult to do so in these really expensive markets.
We are talking about homelessness, causes, possible solutions. Greg Colburn is with us. His new book is Homelessness is a Housing Problem. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Greg, I pulled up some numbers here in Wisconsin. Our two biggest cities, our two biggest counties, Milwaukee County and Dane County, home of Madison. Milwaukee County, not quite twice as big as Dane County. Their population's gone down a little, but their homelessness rate in the most recent statistics is one of the lowest in the country. Dane County, home of Madison, it is the fastest growing county in the state. Homelessness rate, not that much less than Milwaukee County. In a way, that maps onto how you divvy up a lot of the country. Communities that are successful in some ways, growing population, growing incomes, growing business, facing these homelessness problems. Why?
Well, it really comes down to housing market dynamics. And, Milwaukee certainly falls into the typical Rust Belt city right now. And so if we want to lump Milwaukee, Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland into the same category, those are all cities that have had very prosperous times and have fallen on some more difficult times and had population loss. And one of the there are very few benefits of population loss. One of the benefits of population loss is because housing is durable and it doesn't disappear. When people leave, housing becomes cheaper and more available. Vacancy rates go up and rents go down. And as a result, it is easier for those communities to house its people, both those working who aren't working and those who are vulnerable. as soon as you start to see some population growth and those pressures start to form in the housing market, it starts to be less accommodating. And that really comes down to an issue then, whether that's Madison, whether that's Austin, Texas, or Boise, Idaho, other places that are growing quickly, will that community scale its housing production to the level of population growth? And if they do, that's great. Charlotte, North Carolina has done a wonderful job of that. Cities like Seattle have not. We've had a massive tech boom. We've had all sorts of people move here, and we haven't constructed enough housing, which has created a housing crisis. And so for these mid-sized cities like Madison or Boise or other places that are experiencing growth, the warning, that I deliver to those communities is you've got to keep your eye on the housing supply side of the equation, because if you don't, you end up with these supply-demand imbalances that really exert some negative influences or impacts on people in that community.
What is holding back housing development in these communities that, again, by SimCity terms or other games like that, they're winning, they're growing, they're having more money, more revenue, things like that. But what is leading them to lose by not having this housing supply and driving up?
Yeah, well, one, housing production does take a long time. And so you can't just flip a light switch and increase housing supply tomorrow. And but generally speaking, and this is a very brief economics lecture here, but economists measure supply elasticity, which would be how responsive your supply is to changes. And there are communities that have very elastic housing supply responses. And there are other communities like San Francisco, which are super inelastic, which means prices can go way up and you don't build housing. The two factors that determine the elasticity of housing in a market is one, topography. If you have mountains and water, that's going to constrain your ability to construct housing. Obviously, Madison doesn't have that constraint like Seattle or San Francisco does. And the other one is the regulatory environment in which you operate. There are places where it's easier to build and there are places where it's harder to build. And if you have a place that's hard to build from a regulatory standpoint, it will make your housing response less elastic. And that's something that fast-growing cities need to keep their eye on. And one of the reasons why housing ends up being inelastic in a lot of places is because people who typically own single family homes are frequently not excited about changing the built environment. And so they will oppose measures to densify a city and create more housing, more multifamily housing, et cetera. And so those kind of small scale decisions that are made at the local level can have big impacts on how a community is able to respond to population growth.
We're talking to Greg Colburn, professor of real estate at the University of Washington. His new book is Homelessness is a Housing Problem. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see a shortage of housing that people can afford, housing that you can afford in your community, even if it's not driving you into homelessness? Are you seeing that pressure? Do you have questions? Do you have thoughts on solutions to homelessness in your community, in the country at large? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Oh yeah, if you want to see more housing in your community, what's holding it back, if anything? 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Greg Colburn, real estate professor at the University of Washington. His new book is Homelessness is a Housing Problem, How Structural Factors Explain U.S. Patterns. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, maybe your experiences with affordable or unaffordable housing, homelessness in the community you live in now or used to live in. 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Randy is with us in La Crosse. Randy, hi.
Yeah, hi. I noticed that originally your guest was not using the term affordable housing, because that's really the bane of this whole thing. We were foreclosed on by the wonderful people at J.P. Morgan Chase, and we ended up moving to the Twin Cities in Minnesota and renting a home owned by J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo, who were buying up all the available homes in the area, all the nice homes, and renting them to hold them. And that we allow these hedge funds to come together with all the money in the world and buy everything up and hold it and rent it. And it's just, we're shooting ourselves in the foot constantly.
Randy, sorry to hear about your foreclosure, but I hear that concern, Greg, that we have investment groups, hedge fund and others buying up properties, using them for rental. How big a part of the story is that?
Well, that is a growing concern. And in fact, some colleagues and I wrote a paper on the growth of institutional investors buying single family homes and turning them into rental. And so it is a growing problem. It's been a particularly big problem in the Sun Belt, where after the foreclosure crisis, institutional investors swooped in and bought up all sorts of homes. And we're now seeing that activity picking up coming out of COVID. And so your caller is absolutely correct that this is a growing issue. I would say in places where we see really high rates of homelessness, like Seattle and San Francisco, that activity hasn't been as great, mainly because the cost of housing is so significant. And so when people blame institutional investors for homelessness in Seattle, I will frequently say that's really not a big issue. But when you get into smaller communities where these investors have been active, it's clearly taking supply out of the market. And one of the biggest impacts is for people who want to be first-time home buyers and own a home, and they're competing with Blackstone or other well-heeled firms, and they're probably not going to win that competition very often. And so it is having a big impact on the ability of people to become homeowners at some point in their life. So it's an important topic and one that's getting additional attention. I think what will be interesting is to see what the policy response is to that activity. Will there be certain guardrails or constraints put on those investors to ensure that they don't gobble up all the available inventory in a particular community?
Randy, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Brian joins us now in Dubuque. Brian, hi.
Hi, sir. How are you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I lived in Los Angeles and for my work, I have to travel to Seattle quite often. So this is not an indictment on homeless people one bit, but I will say this. Most of the homeless people that I have communicated with quite frequently, majority were single men. They weren't family men out there looking for a home. So whatever their priorities were, motivations was up to them. But my thought is that, you know, I moved from there just for that reason. Is, you know, the homes there were so expensive even 20 years ago when I was there, and came to Iowa, and the same $500,000 home in California was $140,000 here. And so even if I took a little bit of a pay cut coming to Iowa, the cost of living was so significantly less that it was advantageous to do so. So I would say this is that if somebody is really hell-bent on being a homeowner, then it seems to me that the natural migration would be where that's acceptable to do so, not sticking somewhere and hoping to, you know, reroute their river with something that's not affordable.
Brian, thanks for the call. To his second point, Greg, it seems like there should be that kind of market solution where, hey, nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded. As Yogi Berra used to say, that people will sort out by moving from L.A. to Dubuque, say.
Absolutely. It's a great point, and it's a question that I frequently get. I think there are two issues here. One is, you want to buy a home, and it might be easier to do that in Dubuque or Omaha or Topeka than it is in Seattle or LA. And that's absolutely true. And I think we are going to see some mobility there. The other argument that I frequently hear is, if you're homeless in Seattle, why don't you move? Why don't you go to Dubuque or Topeka or whatever the case may be? And this is one of the key points, you know, that we raise in the book, is that generally speaking, homelessness is a homegrown problem, meaning the people experiencing homelessness in your community are from your community. And the reason that these people aren't moving is because moving is difficult. I'm actually from the Midwest. I moved my family from Minneapolis out to Seattle 6 years ago when I began my work at UW. And moving is hard. It's expensive. It's traumatic. You know, you have relationships that you're leaving, et cetera. And imagine that you're at the end of your rope. You have no income, or you have very low income. You don't have a place to live. Just the practical ability to move from one location to another is really undermined by not having resources. And then what are you going to do when you get there if you don't have a job? The other thing that's really important is social networks are absolutely critical to all of us, and they are even more critical for people at the very low end of the income spectrum. You know, your mom or brother or someone who can help care for your kids is essential to you because you don't have the resources to do that. And so mobility at the very low end of the income spectrum is very low in that you require some resources to be mobile. And so, yes, if you are unemployed and you want to improve your standard of living by moving to Dubuque, people will certainly do that, as the caller did. If you're experiencing homelessness in Seattle, the idea that they're going to up and move to Topeka to have a better life is, one, doesn't happen for practical reasons, and also the data would suggest that that's really not happening very much.
Brian, thanks for that call. We're talking to Greg Colburn about his new book, Homelessness is a Housing Problem. Brian also mentioned, you know, single men in the homeless community versus families. What do we know about the proportions and whether that affects the solutions we want to look for?
Yeah, one of the challenges we have in homelessness is I use the iceberg analogy in the sense that an iceberg, you only see a very small fraction of that iceberg above the water, and the rest is not visible below the water. And that's true for homelessness as well. And so as the prior caller indicated, if you walk around in Seattle or Los Angeles right now, you will come away with a perception of the homelessness crisis, which is single men who are addicted or mentally ill, and therefore that's what homelessness is. What we're not seeing when we walk around downtown Seattle are all the women and children who are in shelter. We're not seeing the Starbucks employees who can't afford a place to live and are living in their cars or in a camper somewhere in Seattle. And so this visible experience that we have distorts our understanding. And so it's certainly most visible, but that is not the vast majority of people experiencing homelessness. You know, maybe 25, the best estimates are 25% of the people experiencing homelessness are addicted or mentally ill in some way, which means 75% of the homeless population don't have those issues, but they're likely experiencing poverty or some other hardship. And so that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book, is really to help people understand what this crisis is all about. And therefore, we need to be thinking about the women and children in shelter, as well as the mentally addicted single man on the street, when we think about our solutions.
Now, some of the solutions you've already pointed to, allowing more housing to be built, is a big one. More fundamentally, it seems like you're looking for a mindset shift about how we think about homelessness and the causes of homelessness. What kind of mindset are you hoping people, especially decision makers, take as they look at homelessness?
Well, I think one of the key issues here is, and I talk about this when I give public talks, is when we blame individuals for the outcome that they've achieved, it allows us a certain amount of freedom and flexibility to not take ownership of that issue. Right? Rob has made poor decisions, therefore Rob's experiencing homelessness. And while I feel bad for Rob, I don't feel any responsibility for that. Once we shift the narrative to say that in many of our communities, we have not created enough housing for people who need it, that's something that we all collectively own and have responsibility for as both policymakers, as well as people who vote and people who live in homes and make decisions about what our built environment looks like. And so that's really the shift that I think we need to make, which is we need to ensure that there's sufficient housing for people of all income levels in our communities. And failure to do that will exacerbate this homelessness crisis. And we have a responsibility for that. And so I really, and we're seeing a big shift in the narrative around homelessness towards housing being a key issue, which I'm grateful for at both the federal, the state, and local level. And I think those conversations need to continue. And I would certainly hope that your elected leaders would focus on that as well.
In just our last minute or so, is there a community you would point local leaders to say, hey, these are people who tackled this problem in a positive way?
Well, there's two communities, and one is in your backyard there. There are two communities that have done a really good job. One is Houston and one is Milwaukee, and they have used the Housing First model to get a lot of people housed. And so they are shining examples in the United States of success story of using the Housing First model, which is ensuring that people get housed, get stabilized, and then ultimately receive the services that they need once they are in a more stable position, as opposed to saying, you need to clean up before we'll give you housing, which doesn't work very well. Now, one of the reasons why Houston and Milwaukee were able to do that is they do have housing available to basically scale the Housing First intervention to the scale of the problem. Whereas we use Housing First in Seattle, but we don't have units to place people in, and therefore it's not as effective. And so what I'm really grateful for in Milwaukee and Houston is they've used the housing market advantages that they have and leveraged that to get people housed. And so I really hope that communities around the nation can follow the lead of Milwaukee and Houston and use that model. And where in the communities where housing is not abundant or near, anywhere near sufficient, making sure that we not only use Housing First, but also scale that housing production such that we can use those interventions that we know work.
Greg, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Greg Colburn is an assistant professor of real estate in the University of Washington's College of Built Environment. He was with us today sharing his new book, Homelessness is a Housing Problem, How Structural Factors Explain U.S. Patterns. Coming up after the news, we talk to a travel expert about the thousands of flights canceled by Southwest Airlines during the holidays and what we can learn about air travel in the future. If you had a travel experience by air over the holidays that went well or went poorly, you can let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the...